today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us today. Health is one of the things that it's really hard to measure through statistics. Many people think of health in terms of physical well-being. That includes things like getting enough sleep, nutrition, water, and exercise. But of course, health is also more expansive than that. It includes social well-being and mental health and feeling like you belong in some ways to a larger purpose. The University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute recently published a report on civic health, and it really caught my attention. The report claims that civic health is determined in part by a county's civic infrastructure, which includes places for people to meet, have their voices heard, engage in cultural activities, enjoy nature, and feel a sense of belonging. Being in good civic health means having access to things like broadband internet, living close to a park or recreation facility, and maintaining low levels of racial segregation. That same report found that here in Wayne County, we have really poor civic health. So to talk about that health outcome and the relatively poor overall health outcomes that so many of us here in Wayne County struggle with, we have someone here who has a lot of ideas about that with us. Dr. Abdul El Sayed is the health director for Wayne County. He, of course, also used to be the health director here in the city of Detroit, and he was a gubernatorial candidate in 2018. Abdul, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Stephen, it's always a privilege to join you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So before we get into specifics on resident health, I just want to talk a little about the job. You have been on that job now for just a little bit. Talk about the things that you're learning and the things that you're seeing from, a bit of the lens pulled back, right? You used to be the health director in Detroit. Wayne County is a bigger jurisdiction. What are some of the things that strike you as different or maybe even the same as what you saw when you were here in the city?
Yeah, Stephen. In my past experience, I was the health director for one city, albeit the biggest city in Wayne County. I'm now the health director for 42 communities. And I presume a topic that we are going to talk quite a bit about today is inequities. And across Wayne County, you have a pretty dramatic difference in terms of access to the basic resources that can improve someone's health between a place like Northville, which is one of the richest communities in the entire state, versus a place like Highland Park, which is teetering on the verge of bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And to understand a lot of the conversation we're going to have today, it's really important to put yourself in the shoes of someone who lives in Northville versus in the shoes of someone who lives in Highland Park.
I mean, the disparity there is one of the things that I think we talk a lot about on this show, and that we think about a lot in this city. And when you invoke those two communities, that's probably maybe one of the widest disparities that exist. Talk about why in 2023, given all of the things that we have gone through as a nation, all of the things that we've learned, why does that persist? I mean, it may seem like a kind of naive question, but it seems like that we should be narrowing those gaps and that we're not. Am I right about that?
That's absolutely right. And this is in part a story of the 20th century in this country. It is, when you look at how populations came to Michigan, there was so much migration, mainly from the South, of black folk, but then also migration into this country from all kinds of places in the world, like my own father did. And when you look at the folks who located into a place like Northville, they tended to come with higher degrees, with the opportunity to slot directly into professional class jobs. Whereas you look at Highland Park, and after the 1960s, what was left over because of racial residential segregation tended to be black folk who had come here during the Great Migration, who were slotted into the lowest paying jobs. And even in those jobs, kept without access to moving up. And so this is the consequence of generations of failed economic mobility. And we know that one of the most important predictors of health is income. And then it's not just income, but it's also wealth. So even if you've escaped poverty in one generation, what you grew up in is still going to have consequences for all of that path dependency in terms of how your body came to and your mind came to the current point that they sit at their health. And so addressing these inequities in 2023 has to be a primary goal. And if we're serious about taking on that top line measure of life expectancy, we have to be serious about correcting that huge chasm. Because unless we lift the floor, right, then we're not really going to be able to achieve the height of the ceiling.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned it, but I want to drill down on it just a little. Race has an awful lot to do with these disparities still, even though from a legal perspective, there isn't the kind of discrimination that used to exist in this country. It still is a driver of this kind of inequality. Talk about why that's true still in places like Wayne County.
You know, it's not race, it's racism.
Yes.
If you're the only one without an umbrella in the rain, then you're the one who's going to get wet. And oftentimes in health metrics, you know, I trained as an epidemiologist, Stephen, and for a long time I was trained to use race as a proxy to understand the pernicious effects of, you name the disease. But it's not really the race issue, right? Because you're black or because I'm Middle Eastern, North African, that doesn't really change our organ systems. I can tell you, as someone who's gone to medical school, we look the same on the inside. We really, really do. The issue, though, is that race is a proxy for being exposed to this thing out in the ether, which is racism. And the way that racism applies itself is that it's like a residue. Once it's been pushed out, it stays there for a while. It shapes the dynamics of institutions. It shapes the dynamics of structures. It changes who gets promoted, who doesn't get promoted, who gets access to a high quality school. And all of that goes back to a set of decisions that we often make that implant it into the most important decisions we make as a society. So you think about the way that we fund public schools, for example. We fund them based on property tax. And property tax value is a function of the value of property. And so if we've had racial residential segregation and redlining in the past, what we're doing is porting that past into our future by saying we are going to withhold funding from some schools and not others. So you look at a Northville Public Schools, which is one of the best performing and highest funded public school districts in the entire state, I would say in the entire country, and compare it to schools at DPSCD or Highland Park or Inkster. And the difference there isn't as much that you don't have super bright minds at both of these schools. The difference is that the soil in which these bright minds are growing up is fundamentally different because we've systematically disinvested in these other schools because they just don't have the same property tax values. And when we make that policy decision, what we're doing is we're carrying the racism of the past into the future. And the thing I want folks to understand is that racism is less about what one individual says to another.
That's
because
right.
People will hear what I'm saying here and say, well, I'm not racist. And I send my kid to Northville Public School, and I'm not saying you are. I'm saying that we have not fixed the ways that racism has instantiated itself into the policy choices that we make to address the long-term outcomes and the disparities in those outcomes. And so much of what we're going to talk about when it comes to life expectancy, especially right now, has to do with the well-being of young people.
Yeah,
and unless we're serious about investing in our young people the same way, then we should not be surprised when the consequences of racist structures in the past then continue to pattern access to the basic means of a dignified life for kids in the future.
Yeah. And the way that all of those inequalities end up affecting health outcomes is very vivid. But even beyond that, the fact that somebody suffers diminished health outcomes in their lifetime adds to the intergenerational effect of this kind of racism. So my father, for instance, if my father is someone who can't get access to proper health care, is poor because he doesn't have the same opportunities as someone else, that means that my outcomes, my my potential is curtailed because of that. And that's why we see this repeat itself over and over and over again. It is absolutely cyclical, and it's really hard, I think, for a lot of people to really understand that that is what we're battling.
That's absolutely right. I want to offer you just an anecdote to help shape this. I got a friend of mine, young black man. He has a fantastic job and great healthcare. And I was talking about the experience of going to a doctor, and he said, I don't go to the doctor. I said, why not? He said, listen, this is the first time in my life I've had stable access to insurance. And growing up, my parents were between Medicaid and no insurance at all. And so I was taught that if you go to the doctor sees you as a second-class citizen because the reimbursements for Medicaid are way lower. And that's a choice that we've made in our healthcare system to rob folks of a basic access to healthcare. And the way that patterns is that kid has escaped the poverty of his youth. And at the same time, the lessons he learned because of the lessons our system taught about how you will be treated as someone who codes as a Medicaid patient, as a poor black kid in a low-income urban environment, that's going to port itself into the future. So when we were talking about, and this came up in the conversation about, I'm reaching the age, Stephen, where I'm starting to have to think about colonoscopy. And, you know, I was telling him, as a good doctor should, that this is something you really should be thinking about. You need to do it. There are high rates of colon cancer in our communities. And he said, yeah, I'm not doing that. And you can imagine if this is a person in whose body a polyp is going to start growing into a cancer, the probability that it gets caught as a function of the way that our system treats poverty is going to be lower.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that we have to take on. And so a lot of this is about structure and the way that structure ports. You look at that transition of life, the probability of infant mortality or maternal mortality, right at that moment when a new baby is being born. Infant mortality among black babies is 1 to 2 times as high. Maternal mortality is 3 to 4 times as high in black babies and moms. And you think about why, and it all goes back to a set of choices we as a society make about who gets access and who doesn't get access to health systems, and not just access, the ability to walk in, but knowing you're not going to be hounded by a biller on the back end, knowing you're going to be treated with dignity and respect by your doctor. They're not going to blame you for your circumstances. I mean, I think about the fact that my wife, Sarah, we just had a baby, 3-month-old, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And in one of the first visits, I was tied up with work. And the question that they asked Sarah wasn't, is dad involved? The question is, tell us about dad. With the assumption, right, that I was in the picture. And I talked to a lot of my black colleagues and friends about their experience. And the question that is asked is dad involved? And the amount of racism and stereotyping that is packed into that one question.
That's right.
Right? As you are going in this vulnerable moment in the beginning of your pregnancy to start a relationship with someone who's supposed to bring your new baby in the world, what does that tell you about how you're valued, about what is assumed about you, and yeah, about the questions that people are going to ask then about all kinds of other behaviors, which will implicitly blame you for the circumstances in which you find yourself. And that is a terrible problem. We don't think about these things, but these are scripts that we consistently teach. I mean, I learned these scripts in medical school, just watching the way that different patients were cared for. These are the ways that our policy shapes behavior, the ways that those behaviors on the part of people who are supposed to be there to help can then be a detriment to getting care that folks need, that then help to create these deep inequities. And until we're serious about rooting those things out, right, then we are going to continue to watch as we continue to suffer profound disparities across our society.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Abdul El Sayed, who is the health director here in Wayne County, about health outcomes for us here in Wayne County. We're going to get a little more specifically into this report about overall health outcomes and how poorly Wayne County stacked up there. We want to hear from you as well on the phones and on social. Give us a call if you live in Wayne County. Talk about the health outcomes for you and your neighbors in whatever city you live in. What do you think can be done at the state level to help improve your health outcomes? And what do you think the county and state are doing to improve residents' health? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll include you that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined us. We've got Dr. Abdul El Sayed with us. He is the health director in Wayne County, former gubernatorial candidate, and former executive director of the Detroit Health Department. We are talking about health outcomes here in Wayne County, a report that I saw recently that really caught my attention because of the way it describes health outcomes and opportunities here in Wayne County and how they contrast to other counties here, especially in Michigan. We want to hear from you as well during the conversation. Call and tell us, especially if you live in Wayne County, what your health outcomes are like, what those are of your neighbors, what are they like in your community, and how do they contrast with other parts of the metro area and the state. 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. Okay, Abdul, I want to talk about this report that that I saw. And again, it is by the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. And what really caught my eye was a map that they published. And it's a map of variations in socioeconomic opportunity among U.S. counties. Counties with really great outcomes were in blue, and counties with poorer outcomes were in red or orange. And if you look at the state of Michigan on this map, there were some rural counties that jumped out to me, but the one that really stood out, I thought, was Wayne County in terms of the negative outcomes that they associated with it, and also the contrast, right? So you've got Wayne County in orange or red on the map, and the counties around us, Oakland, Washtenaw, Macomb, are in blue. It really just made me stop and think for a second again about the things that we were talking about in the previous segment, these institutional structures, infrastructures that really hold people back for a number of reasons, including racism, including poverty, all of these things that we struggle with. So I want to get your reaction to that report. We did share the report with folks in your office, and I know that you've taken a look. You're the health director here. That map has to strike you a little more, I think, severely than it even does me.
I'll tell you, that is the central focus of everything we're doing at the county. I'm in Wayne County right now doing this work because of a vision that Executive Evans has about where we need to go to address exactly that problem. You wind the clock back 8 years. This is a county that was on the verge of bankruptcy with its principal city, Michigan's largest city, working through bankruptcy. And those were the circumstances in which I'd had my role in the city of Detroit. The moment now, though, is recognizing the circumstances that COVID has demonstrated to us that need to be addressed, the kind of resilience that we need to be invested in. And I really appreciate the context within which you're painting this, because it really is about economic opportunity, and it's about all of the things in an environment that we need to address. And the county executive, Warren Evans, has laid out a vision where he says, what are all the pieces that we can tackle? What are all the aspects of the lived experience of somebody in Wayne County that we can take on to address the ways that they are kept unhealthy or the opportunities we have to invest in their health? So we're thinking about big picture items like, can we build a system of air monitors to address the air pollution that we know is such a challenge that robs children of their breath in their early age through asthma? Can we address that transition in early life by building a system of birthing centers in our community that target and focus on providing resources for those who are most likely to suffer the loss of an infant or the loss of a life in childbirth? Can we use some of the programs that we have in our county as ways to give folks a one-up? So can we invest in small business by offering free health insurance for small businesses as they get up, which is both an opportunity to invest in socioeconomics, but also to do so through health? And that vision is what I'm working on executing every single day under the direction of CEO Evans. I also say this, some of the challenges that we are taking on are a function of compounded history. Mm-hmm. And whether it was the potential, the risk of bankruptcy that the CEO had to take on 8 years ago, or it is the consequences of systems of structural inequity that we're taking on when it comes to health today, these are all part of a set of decisions that we made in history. And a lot of our work is about correcting those inequities and taking off that residue of racism that has shaped so many of the nuances of the lives of people in our county.
Yeah. The other thing that I want to make sure we really hit on before we move on to some other points out of this report is this linkage that they're making between things like socioeconomic opportunity and health, right? People with diminished opportunity to take care of themselves, to move up in the world, to provide for their families, end up in many cases with diminished health outcomes as well. And it's not coincidence. I mean, one leads to the other.
Yeah. I want to speak specifically to what is driving life expectancy right now in our country. So we had 3 years of falling life expectancy between 2015 and 2017. And the causes were called the deaths of despair. They were overdose and suicide. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, there has been an accentuation of those challenges because of all the ways that COVID-19 took a life. It took it directly, but it also accentuated the mental illness that drove opioid overdose and suicide. But there's another piece here too. If you look at post-COVID, countries across the world that have similar socioeconomic profiles to ours have started to recover. Their life expectancy is going back up. Ours has been nosediving. And when you look at why, the consequences go back to those issues and one more, which is opioid overdose and the spiraling issue of opioids. Death by suicide. And I just want to mention here that if you are someone who's contemplating, make sure you dial 988, that there's a suicide prevention hotline. We need you here. People love you here, and I hope that you'll get the care you need. But there's a third one here too, and that is homicide. That's homicide among kids. Now, mm-hmm. I want you to think about those two together, suicide and homicide. One of the things people don't appreciate is that the highest probability of a death by a gun is inflicted by the person holding the gun. The biggest consequence of gun violence in our country is suicide. That being said, when there is homicide, if you look at the victims, it's not the victims that you hear about on news channels when there are mass shootings in predominantly white communities. It is one-off murders in communities like ours, predominantly black and brown children. And so what connects death by suicide and death by homicide? Guns. And guns make suicidality or suicidal ideation that much more dangerous. And guns are the reason why homicide is so high in our societies. And so it is that juxtaposition between mental illness and not just mental illness, but social isolation mm-hmm. and stress, like the socioeconomic consequences are causing so many people in lower income communities. And then it's the way that those things are made so deadly because of the ubiquity of guns, because of the choices that we make in our public policy.
Yeah. I mean, we see it every day in places like Detroit, and it doesn't get, it doesn't get the attention that some of the mass shootings, and I'm not saying that it's a competition, but it doesn't get the kind of focus that the mass shootings that we see in other communities seem to get. And again, when you think about, for instance, what happened this weekend in Detroit, in downtown, in Greektown, lots of people shot for no reason, right? I mean, these are fights and arguments that 20, 25 years ago would result in, a couple fists being thrown. Now it's just too easy to get a gun and kill somebody or really injure somebody. And in our communities, this is the driver of, as you point out, the distinction between what happens with our health outcomes and everybody else's.
That's right. And I want to be clear about something. Every incident of gun violence is an atrocity that should not happen. The challenge is that when the victims look a certain way, the narrative says this is uncommon and atrocious. Mm-hmm. But when the victims look a different way, it's baked into what we consider as normal.
People
and so
say
it's not covered.
It's predictable. Right?
Exactly. And you know, the nature of news, right, is new. And you can tell what people think is new versus not new, what they pack as normal versus not normal, based on what they cover and we talk about in the news. And so what I'm saying is, yes, we need to continue to cover mass shootings in places like Oxford or at MSU. Those are atrocious. They should never happen. We need to do something about them. But we should also be covering gun violence and the victims of gun violence in communities like Detroit or Highland Park the same way. And we should be profiling those victims and earning their sympathy in the same way that we would everyone else. And I think part of the important aspect of talking about that is, what connects those two things? It's the ubiquity of a gun that can take a moment of rage or a moment of frustration or a moment of destitution and turn it into a lost life. And unless we're serious about addressing both that moment of desperation, that moment of anger, or that moment of destitution, and the gun that made it lethal, we're going to continue to see this problem. I just want to be clear about something. In the United Kingdom, for example, the probability of dying between the ages of 5 and 25 is about 1%. In the U.S., it's 4%. It's four times as high.
Wow.
And when you calculate life expectancy, right, you always think about life expectancy as a certain number of years, right? Right now, it's right about 76 years. The loss of a young life is so, it contributes so much higher to bringing down that life expectancy.
Yes.
And so, you know, you hear these statistics about places back in the day, right? They'll say the life expectancy in medieval Europe was 38. And people get this assumption that people are just dropping dead at 38. That's not how it happened. The way it happened was that when you average the number of babies who died and the number of children who died relative to the number of adults who died, yes, adults were dying in their 60s way earlier than adults die today. But the reason their life expectancy wasn't 60 and it was 38 is because of the number of babies who've died. And what has protected us from babies dying has been things like investing in basic hygiene systems that carry dirty water away from the water we drink, mm-hmm. vaccinations, antibiotics, those things are great. But what's happening right now is because of the pressure cooker of social isolation, of poverty, all made more lethal by guns, what we're seeing is this newfound increase in death in the moment in which your life is supposed to be safest, which is in your early adulthood. People in their early adulthood are not supposed to die, but they're dying at way higher clips because we've created an atomized society where life is just getting harder and harder for these kids, and we've made it more lethal because of the access that they have to guns to take those feelings and turn them into a final outcome.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go to Frank in Green Oak Township. Frank, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. Just struck me what the doctor said about the suicide prevention hotline. And, you know, I don't know how well that works, but why not a homicide prevention hotline where somebody can call, you know, especially younger people? Maybe we could head some of that off at a lot of these school shooters have had, you know, many months of this feeling of rage that they want to kill somebody. So maybe if there was some place that they could call to talk about it anonymously.
Yeah, I don't know, Frank. Don't know. I'm not sure how that would work. I think it's an interesting idea. But Abdul, talk about a little more about how well the suicide prevention hotline works, but whether I guess something like that could help us with homicides.
Well, the suicide prevention hotline is an extremely important resource. And again, that number is 988. And it's one of those numbers that you just have to have on the tip of your tongue, just like we know about 911, which I argue is probably the closest thing we have to the homicide prevention hotline.
Sure.
The key thing though, and Frank, I think the big point that you're making here is that we have a profound level of unmet need to address the social isolation that so many of the people who end up involved in gun violence experience. I mean, you think about gang activity, right? What is gang activity except for the need to find community sometimes in the least healthy and in most detrimental kinds of ways? And so we have an epidemic right now of social isolation that is creating circumstances in which people are going without the support and investment in terms of time and energy that they need and deserve. And unfortunately, that turns deadly because of access to guns. But I do want to say something clear here, is that there is social isolation, and social isolation is going up in many other countries. There is destitution and frustration in many other countries. The one difference in ours is that there are more guns than there are people, which allow that destitution and frustration to be turned into violence in a far more deadly and higher volume way.
Yeah. Again, Frank, really appreciate the call and the comments. Abdul, we're going to run out of time, but I do want to get you to talk about the coming return of water shutoffs that is scheduled here in Detroit. For me, when you talk about health outcomes and putting them in danger, I can't think of a lever that you would pull that would have a more direct relationship to that. And yet we continue to have this conversation here in Southeast Michigan about whether we're going to stop people from having fresh water.
Big frustration to me on this issue is that we are the state with more fresh water than any other state in the country. I mean, between Arizona and California and Colorado, they're trying to decide how to divvy up a singular, smaller river that's running out of water. Mm-hmm. It's become a rivulet. We've got five Great Lakes right here that we could pull from, and we do. And the challenge that I see is that we allow major corporations like Nestle to bottle our water for a simple fee and not have to pay like ratepayers in places like Highland Park or Detroit. And we have not guaranteed the same access to water for folks in our state. And as we look at where we are as a state, right, we've been blessed in this moment to have so much money that the state is trying to figure out what to do with it. I would say that a really, really smart investment would be to guarantee people in our state that basic thing that makes up 70% of our body. And this, unfortunately, has been left to some combination of municipal policy and individual households to pay, rather than the state taking it on and deciding that we're going to take this on.
Yeah. I mean, I every time I see the stories about it, I think there has got to be a way to get past this. I mean, other communities don't do it this way, and I worry about all kinds of things that would be possible if you had mass water shutoffs again here in Detroit. Okay, Abdul El-Sayed, it is always great to catch up with you. Congratulations on the new baby.
Thank you.
Very exciting. And congratulations on your work so far in this new job as the health director in Wayne County. Thanks for coming by today.
Stephen, always a privilege. Thank you.
That's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when we are going to talk with Pulitzer Prize winning poet and Detroit native Kyamba Jess. Also, if you like this show and get a lot out of it, share it. Share it with your friends and your neighbors and your family. We want this to be a community where everybody feels like they are a part of it. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station. Your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.